Thanks everyone for coming first thing in the morning, and I'd also like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this fantastic conference. So what I mean exactly by synthetic gauge fields with neutral atoms, I'm going to try to make exactly clear throughout this talk, and why I just didn't say vector potential also will become clear. So the majority of the data in the first part of the talk was taken by a fantastic postdoc, Yu Ju Lin, who's moving on to a permanent position. And the experiment has been taken over by a graduate student, Karina Jimenez-Garcia, who's been responsible for a lot of the latter data. And as always at NIST and JQI, this is in collaboration with senior coworkers, in this case, Trey Porter and Bill Phillips. Okay. So here is the overall outline of this talk. I'm going to start by how we use counterpropagating Raman beams to create effective dress states for atoms. So this is the essential geometry of all of our experiments. And I'll show how these dress states can have a term in the Hamiltonian which looks like a vector potential, in this case in the kinetic energy x part of the Hamiltonian. And this is a sort of a sampling of what this vector potential looks like as a function of a control parameter. And then I'm going to show by how by making that vector potential either temporally or spatially dependent, we introduce either effective electric or magnetic fields into the system. So this is an image of what happens when there's a magnetic field applied to the system. And for the final part of the talk, I'm going to show some newer data showing how in the same system we can create not a vector potential, but something that looks more like a spin orbit coupling. So it's a term in the Hamiltonian here, Kx is coupling to a sigma y Pauli matrix. And we're going to see what happens when we put bosons into that situation. So let me give a sense of what my overall personal motivation for doing these kinds of experiments are. And I'm going to say the fundamental motivation is to study interesting many-body systems, but I'd like to make what I mean by interesting somewhat more precise than just complicated. So what I mean by interesting is that the elementary excitations of the system are qualitatively different than the constituent particles. So a Fermi gas by this metric is not interesting because the elementary excitations are still fermions with, if they had charge, charge E. So I'm thinking more of systems like quantum Hall systems, where, for example, for the nu equals 1/3 fractional quantum Hall state, the ingredients are electrons, but the elementary excitations have fractional charge and fractional statistics. So this is sort of the general category of systems that I'm interested in trying to realize in the long term with systems often called neutral atoms. So if that's one's goal, then there's sort of a menu of condensed matter systems that you might try to realize with cold atoms. And if you look through this menu, you realize that there's a lot of neat systems, quantum Hall systems, quantum magnets, P-wave superconductors, and more recently, topological insulators, or their surfaces, or them near other stuff. Now, these all sound great, but there are certain hindrances to realizing them with such systems of ultra-cold atoms. So for quantum Hall physics, you have the fundamental problem, you have charge-neutral particles. If you put them in the magnetic field, you do not get Landau levels. Okay? So that's a problem. We need to make a magnetic field for neutral particles. Quantum magnets are difficult, at least for the neutral atoms, because there aren't long-range interactions. So if you have atoms in a lattice, you'd like a nearest neighbor spin-dependent interaction. You'd like to get some frustration. But if you have contact interactions, you're relying on T-squared over U kind of exchange things, which are kind of feeble. So maybe a dipolar molecules have some promise there. We have superconductors. That sounds good, too. We have these Feshbach resonances. Why not use a Feshbach resonance? Well, so far, the P-wave Feshbach resonances have also been associated with tragic loss. So this doesn't seem to be a practical route as of yet. And lastly, topological insulators. Well, these are sort of a new idea, and what you need for topological insulators is spin orbit coupling. So I'll get back to our sort of initial steps to spin orbit coupling at the end of the talk. So here, I'll be trying to take the steps at the beginning of the talk about how we might ultimately realize fractional quantum Hall systems for bosons. So in terms of a very simple introduction, I'd like to remind you of what magnetic fields do to neutral atoms and what we want them to do to neutral atoms. So this is more for the condensed matter people in the audience and to give a sense of my dimensions and so forth. So the atom I'm working with is rubidium-87. We're going to be in the ground electronic manifold, which has an F equals 1 and an F equals 2 total angular momentum manifold of states. And what I'm plotting is the energy of these states as a function of field measured in Gauss. So what you see is that there's a Zeeman effect. The Zeeman effect doesn't just have the linear Zeeman effect, meaning that the spacing is different between the levels as the magnetic field increases, so there's a quadratic Zeeman effect. But essentially, all that's happening is you're changing sort of the static energy of the atom. So that's the Zeeman effect. Whereas what we want is a Lorentz force like this. Okay. The way I'm going to think about this in this talk is not in terms of sort of the freshman physics version, but the junior physics version, where you learned about canonical momentums and vector potentials. So in the end, I want to engineer a Hamiltonian of this form, where there's a canonical momentum P and a vector potential A. And what we want to do is engineer sufficiently flexible vector potentials that they can depend upon space in such a way that the curl is non-zero. So that's the goal. Now, I sort of set this up that you need to engineer magnetic fields for neutral atoms because they're chargeless. But there's already one well-known way of creating what looks like magnetic fields for neutral atoms, and that way is rotation. So I've illustrated some beautiful pictures with large vortex number of rotating systems. So in the rotating frame, you acquire this Hamiltonian, which has a Coriolis force parameterized by these effective vector potentials there and there. And there's a centripetal anti-trapping term there. So from the point of view of a theoretician, problem solved. You can make an artificial magnetic field, spin it fast enough, you go to lowest Landau level, you can see everything you want to do quantum Hall physics. Unfortunately, the reality of the laboratory has impeded that sort of logical progression. And the limit, apparently, technically, is you can't get more than several hundred vortices into these systems. And it's limited by several effects, one of which you need to have an extremely smooth potential, otherwise you have deceleration effects. And how do you make them spin that fast in the first place? So there are technical questions. But for doing certain experiments, this works beautifully. In the meantime, once the theorists realized the experimentalists were having problems, a sort of a selection of new proposals have been created, which I'm listing some of here. And we looked at the selection and picked one, which we're going to generally categorize as Raman techniques. So here's a photograph of vortices entering into our system, now using Raman coupling. So the essential idea is we're going to have two counterpropagating Raman beams. Using the tuning, we're going to introduce a spatial inhomogeneity along the y direction, and that's going to be enough to make a magnetic field. Again, so from an intuitive level, let me explain. I'll use this cartoon so we can explain what goes on a little later on. So at the lowest level, you can understand our system by thinking about two levels. I'll call them psi1 and psi2. They're split by some energy and described by a diagonal Hamiltonian. All very simple. And these energies are themselves a function of some parameter. We'll specify what that is in a second, but it could be anything. So there's a crossing there. And the idea then is you're going to turn on some kind of coupling. In our case, it's going to be Raman coupling, which is going to open up a gap in the problem whose size is about the coupling strength. In the two-level problem, it is the coupling strength. There are certain cases where Hamiltonians might have a symmetry that makes a gap not open. Our problem is not one of those problems. Gaps open up just like you expect everywhere. Okay, so with that gentle introduction of crossings, avoided crossings, and couplings, what is it precisely that we do? We have the three states at the F equals 1 manifold of rubidium 87, MF equals minus 1, 0, and plus 1. We couple those together with two counterpropagating beams, or later on, two beams intersecting at 90 degrees, but nonetheless exchange momentum along the x direction. So you can think of them as being counterpropagating. This system is in the presence of a physical magnetic field causing a linear Zeeman splitting there. This physical field is aligned along the y direction. Okay, so this is the physical setup we have. The detuning between these two Raman beams is almost exactly equal to the linear Zeeman shift between those levels. If the system is on resonance, then one can, in the rotating frame and with the rotating wave approximation, draw a picture like this. These are a series of levels that have crossings, and they're plotted as a function of wave vector, in particular the momentum of the MF equals zero component. So what this graph means is that I have the kinetic energy of MF equals zero. Then you ask yourself the question, to what states is that coupled by the Raman fields? Well, for example, in MF equals plus 1, you're coupled to atoms moving with minus 2 units of momentum. So I'm showing now what MF equals 0 is coupled to. And if in MF equals minus 1, you're coupled to atoms moving with plus 2 units of momentum. So what are my units? My units are the photon recoil momentum, two of them, because you absorb a photon from one beam and are stimulated to emit into another. And my units of energy here are the photon recoil energy, so just h per squared k recoiled squared over 2m. And for those in the audience, what are these numbers? Well, they're really small for condensed matter standards. 3 kilohertz is ER, or about 140 nanokelvins. So our temperatures have to be pretty small compared to these dimensions. Okay, so this is the general situation. Now, why are these parabola lined up? They're lined up because this is for the case of Raman resonance, where absent the kinetic energy, you would exactly go to an atom with the same energy when you undergo a Raman transition. We can shift these states up and down in energy by slightly changing this linear Zeeman shift, taking off of resonance this Raman transition. So to give a sort of an idea of what happens, let's do that. We're going to change the system so we are four recoils off of Raman resonance, bringing into resonance atoms in MF equals minus 1 with the MF equals 0 population or curve. So we'll start with atoms in the magnetically trappable MF equals minus 1 state, go four recoils from Raman resonance, and suddenly turn on the light. Let's see what happens. Well, we're turning things on suddenly. This is one of the things you can do in these ultracold atom systems. So you start with atoms in MF equals minus 1 state, and you project onto the basis of states described by the Raman-coupled system, and you see rapid unitary evolution according to the new Hamiltonian. So this time is in microseconds. This was an instantaneous kind of thing. And what we do is fit these curves to the expected three-level model to ascertain exactly what a Raman coupling strength is. So this is the one parameter that would otherwise be free in our model. We don't know exactly how bright the laser is in the center of our vacuum system, and by this technique we measure it. That means subsequently, for the rest of my talk, there are no free parameters. Every single thing is determined. Okay, so I showed you instantaneous unitary evolution. The question is, now how do we create artificial vector potentials? So the first thing is we're going to do everything adiabatically. Okay, so we're no longer going to do this kind of unitary pulsing evolution. And we're going to look now to see what the dress states are, not in the limit of small coupling, where little gaps open at all those crossings, but in the limit of large coupling, where any memory of these three bare states is gone. In other words, for small coupling, there are three minima in the lowest energy dress state. As the coupling strength increases, these minima coalesce into this single dispersion curve, which is characterized by having a single minimum, a curvature about that minimum giving an effective mass, and a position. So the case I've given is the on-resonance case, and sort of by symmetry, you can see that the position of this minimum is going to be located at zero. Now, the really neat thing and the crucial piece to understand is that when the detuning is not equal to zero, these bare parabola move about. In this case, we have a detuning of about -4 recoils, and the MF equals -1 atoms are detuned downwards in energy. If you go through this whole exercise again, turn on the coupling, find out the eigenstates, the key thing that happens is the minimum here has moved from zero to a non-zero number. Okay, so that's the key into how we create vector potentials. A vector potential, from the point of view of an equation, is nothing other than a displacement of the minimum of the energy-momentum relation along a particular part of the particular direction. So what we have done along this x direction is shift the minimum of the energy-momentum relation. So this number now, instead of just thinking of it as the momentum of the MF equals zero atoms, instead you should think of it as a quantity like the canonical momentum. Atoms there are at rest. The first derivative of this curve is zero. The group velocity is zero. Okay, so this is some stable group of atoms in the lowest energy dress state. Provided the energy scales of the problem are small compared to this gap, and for us this gap is large, it's many, many recoil, then the atoms stay down there and behave as spinless single component bosons in this lowest energy dress state. So that's the goal. This is how we create an artificial vector potential. So a little later, I'm going to come back to a Hamiltonian, which looks like this, which is actually describing the situation. So I have my units of momentum be the K recoil. So one parabola is displaced by 2, by -2, and my coupling are these off-diagonal couplings, which couple states differing by MF equals 1. Okay, so when we come to spin orbit coupling, we'll get a different version of this Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's a nice picture. I haven't shown you any real data, so let's see how this works out in the laboratory. So data is going to look like this. So what we've done in these experiments is we prepare a system in some way, and then we suddenly turn everything off. It means we turn off the harmonic trap, we turn off the Raman lasers, we turn everything off, except that during this free expansion time, we do turn on a magnetic field gradient, which is aligned along the y direction. The effect of this gradient is just to have the Stern-Gerlach force acting on the atoms and to spatially separate out the different spin components. So this graph then is a map along the horizontal axis of the velocity along the x direction and the spin component along the y direction. So what you can see from this graph is our initial Bose condensate, we haven't done anything to this system, is located in MF equals -1 and at K equals 0. Okay, so our initial system is the BEC, which is at rest. We then developed a relatively elaborate loading procedure, which takes that MF equals 1 magnetically trappable BEC and loads it into the lowest energy dress state. So that procedure is described here, but the upshot is that we can load atoms into this lowest energy state. Here is the state decomposition of that state into the bare states. So what we see is what we expect. Most of the atoms are in MF equals 0 at rest, but some of them are in MF equals -1 with +2 units of momentum, and some of them are MF equals +1 with -2 units of momentum. So this is exactly the set of states that I showed earlier, which were coupled to MF equals 0. Okay, that's nice. We see the state decomposition. And now why does this work? Well, now we make a detuning which is not equal to 0. The location of this minimum shifts from 0. And if we do this sufficiently slowly, adiabatically, in this case with respect to the trapping frequencies, the atoms adiabatically follow this minimum. And after time of flight, we see something different. We see that the atoms have moved, in this case the MF equals 0 population, to a non-zero momentum. Well, this is what you expected, because this state, this minimum of the energy-momentum relation, is no longer made up of atoms at zero momentum and MF equals 0. So if we adiabatically follow, we expect to see this. At the same time, this is kind of peculiar, because the shift, this displacement, is a measurement of this change in the vector potential from what it was initially to what it was finally. In other words, we're actually measuring the change in the vector potential, which is really quite interesting. If we change the detuning by more, this population of MF equals 0 atoms moves even more. Okay, so it's now there. So I'd like to make a point here, is that what we are measuring is the momentum of a particular component of atoms. We're not actually asking how fast are the atoms going. In the trap, they're not moving at all. They're sitting at the minimum of the energy-momentum relation with zero group velocity. So if you take the weighted average of the velocity of that, that, and that, weighted by the number of atoms in each of these orders, you get zero. This is because the turn-off process doesn't change the actual momentum of the atoms. It doesn't change how fast they're going. It just allows you to see the decomposition of the stress state into bare states. Okay, so the momentum, the mechanical velocity, is zero. Okay, so with this first part of my talk, what I've done is summarize how we engineer a vector potential. The vector potential we engineered was spatially uniform and essentially time independent. Okay, so from the point of view of atoms in this lowest energy dress state, it didn't do anything. It was only when we projected the atoms back onto their bare states that we could see anything. So once you trace out the higher energy degrees of freedom, you have single component bosons which have a spatially uniform vector potential, which from their point of view doesn't do anything. So of course we do want to do something. So the way I want to think about this now is that we've engineered a Hamiltonian of this form, where in the kinetic energy part of the Hamiltonian in kx, we have a new term which is like a vector potential. And this vector potential is a function of the detuning from Raman resonance, and it's a function of the coupling strength. If you make either of those two parameters, which we control in the laboratory, time or space dependent, then you can engineer magnetic or electric fields. Okay, so that's how this works. We have a vector potential which parametrically depends upon things you do control in the laboratory. And that was the whole idea. So I'd like to think of this now as a transfer function, which takes something we can control, and we're going to control the detuning, and turns it into something we want, which is a vector potential. So one experiment we performed, which I'll not dwell on, is creating an artificial electric field. So in this system, we created a uniform vector potential, but we change it in time. And you know that a changing vector potential creates an induced electric field. So this is not dissimilar from some charged particle sitting outside a solenoid, where the vector potential is essentially uniform, but there's no magnetic field. And then putting AC current through this wire so that you have an induced electric field outside the solenoid. It's like that system. So what we did is we changed the vector potential and measured the change in the mechanical momentum of the atoms. We said, how fast are the atoms going as a function of how much you change the vector potential? And delightfully, what we see is a line of slope, in this case 1, which is exactly what we expect. So to an accuracy of somewhat less than the percent, we see exactly the change in the mechanical momentum which we were expecting. So this electric field works. It's really neat. But again, I don't want to dwell on it. What I do wish to spend some time on is how we create artificial magnetic fields. So again, we have this term in the Hamiltonian, and what we do in the laboratory is make the detuning a function of y. We simply energize our Mach coils, putting on a magnetic field gradient. So instead of thinking now of this transfer function as a function of detuning, instead you think of it as a function of y position. So the vector potential, living in the x part of the kinetic energy, now depends upon y, meaning it has a non-zero curl. Okay, so that's what we did. We engineered a uniform vector potential along the z direction, by having a vector potential in x depend upon y. So when we executed this experiment, this is what happened. So we performed the same loading procedure I described before, and then we turned on the magnetic field gradient, giving rise to an inhomogeneous vector potential, the different gradient values, thus different vector potentials, and different magnetic fields. And what we see is that for small or no gradient, we see what we saw before, a nice state decomposition. But just as soon as the vector potential reaches a critical value, vortices spontaneously enter into our system. So once again, we're doing this projective measurement where we turn everything off. So you see orders, essentially shadows, at the center component at MF equals +1 and -1. So for the data I show for the rest of this talk, we will continue to do these projective measurements, but we're going to focus on this MF equals 0 component. Okay. When you do experiments, sometimes you have ideas that are good, and sometimes you have ones that were bad. And our idea was that we would create this artificial magnetic field, and then to determine how big it was, we would count the number of vortices. This seems like a pretty good idea. You should get one vortex per flux quanta penetrating the system. Such was my argument. And such illustrated my ignorance that for finite-sized systems, in fact, there's a threshold for the penetration of the first vortex. And even nicer, a fantastic review appeared on the archive not a month after we got this data. So I'm sort of hoping this trend continues, that when I want to know something, a review will appear. So what you actually expect is that the threshold for the penetration of the first vortex into a finite-sized system actually can be quite large. So here I'm plotting the computed flux going through the system as against the number of vortices we actually measure. Okay? So here, my naive argument would have said we were expecting 7 vortices. but yet we saw zero. We never saw any. And this is the finite size effect. And if you actually go do the calculation, in this case we did a GPE calculation owing to certain inhomogeneities in our system, you get this gray line here. And the width of it is from uncertainties in experimental parameters. And you see that as soon as you get past this threshold, when it's finally energetically favorable for a vortex to enter into the system, we do begin to see vortices entering into the system. So we understand really what's going on. And the number of vortices, as this flux becomes larger, should ultimately asymptotically approach this limit I was expecting to see of one vortex per naive flux quanta. Now, this slide is showing you two interesting things. The thing I'd like to really draw your attention to is that not everything is wonderful in the world of Raman coupling. So the red points here are plotting the number of atoms as a function of time. So this experiment is performed in an optical dipole trap, and anytime spontaneous emission occurs, the atoms acquire enough momentum to depart the trap. Okay. So spontaneous emission is converted into atom loss, not heating, in this experiment. So what you see is with a time constant of about 1.5 seconds, the atoms are leaving the system. And in blue, I'm plotting the vortex number, which is also decreasing as a function of time. This effect is resulting because the size of the system is decreasing, so thus the flux is decreasing and the number of vortices decrease. And the reason I want to call your attention to this is that for these kind of coupling schemes in the alkali atoms, this type of spontaneous emission is essentially unavoidable. You're relying on some kind of hopefully large fine structure splitting to give you this Raman coupling. But in the limit of large detunings, the Raman coupling also scales as 1 over detuning squared, just like spontaneous emission. So unlike optical lattices, where the scalar light shift is scaling as 1 over detuning, there's no way to win by getting a 1064 nanometer laser with 200 watts. It just doesn't help. You're at some asymptotic limit if this is the best you can do. So as compared to this experiment with rubidium, we could probably do 50% better, but no better. Okay. So this is a fundamental limit associated with Raman coupling. And why do we want to highlight this? Well, for the alkali atoms, if you want to do these experiments in the alkalis, if you want to do fermions, you're in kind of a tough situation, because lithium-6 and potassium-40 have even smaller fine structure splittings, which by the ratio of that compared to rubidium would decrease this lifetime even more. So it's tough with the fermions, and I'll get back to that. Okay, so I want to conclude my talk now with something we've done that's a little bit newer. Not engineering artificial magnetic fields, but engineering what I'll call spin orbit coupling for the neutral atoms. And we've done the most simple possible form of spin orbit coupling, and simply by adding another laser field, you can do almost fully general spin orbit coupling. Okay, so when I got into this, I didn't know hardly anything about spin orbit coupling, except that some kind of coupling between the orbital motion and the spin. And even that's a misnomer. In condensed matter physics, you're thinking about the coupling between the linear motion and the spin. So you have a series of Hamiltonians which look like this. So I've drawn what's important for us here. We have a kinetic energy term. Potentially, you have a biasing Zeeman field along Z. So these are my Pauli matrices. And what I'm describing then are momentum-dependent Zeeman shifts. Alpha is the Rauschbach coupling, and beta is the Dresselhaus coupling. And materials have these couplings in different amounts. And materials also have other terms, like cubic terms. We're going to have none of that. So to understand intuitively what's going on, you can make plots that look something like this, which plot as a function of the x momentum and y momentum the Zeeman shift. Okay? So Rauschbach has this sort of pleasing symmetric pattern, and Dresselhaus looks rather like a magnetic quadrupole. Okay? And what we're going to do is engineer a particular form of this using the laser beams we already had. So the first thing I want to talk about is what states we're doing. Well, we're actually picking out two states. We're making spin 1/2 bosons. And the way we do this is by selecting a particular pair of states and working at sufficiently large magnetic field that the third state, MF equals plus 1, is detuned by the quadratic Zeeman shift from resonance. So we have a pair of states we've selected out, MF equals minus 1 and 0, that we're going to work on in this problem. This is then the two-level version of the Hamiltonian I showed you earlier in this talk. So it's a 2x2 matrix with the Raman coupling off diagonal, the kinetic energy and the detuning on diagonal. You can massage this Hamiltonian in such a way that it takes on a form like this, a spin orbit coupled form. Now I have my kinetic energy, which came out from expanding that square. I have a line along sigma z, a Zeeman magnetic field. And now I have a coupling between the momentum along the x direction and the spin, or the Pauli matrix along y, plus and along the same direction, the detuning term. So the Hamiltonian I've been talking about the whole time is in fact also a spin orbit coupled Hamiltonian and will behave as such if you're in the right limit. Now I have a big notice here. So what we'd like to do is create more non-trivial spin orbit coupling, which can be rewritten as non-abelian vector fields, okay, non-abelian vector potentials. This is not that. So even though you can complete the squares and make a vector potential out of this that is a matrix, it lives entirely in the x part of the kinetic energy, meaning that it trivially commutes with zero, which is in the y part. So even though it's a vector-valued vector potential, it is not abelian. Okay. Now the Hamiltonian is non-trivial because this sigma y doesn't commute with that sigma z, but it's not a non-abelian vector potential. Okay, so in terms of the pictures I drew before, in terms of spin orbit coupling, what does this look like? Well, here is now what we've created, where the Zeeman field is only along the y direction, but still is a function of momentum along x. And here are the eigenenergies of this as a function of kx on this axis, ky in the in-plane axis. You see a double well in momentum space with a gap given by the Raman coupling. This is distinctly different from, for example, the Rochebach case, where in this plot there is no biasing field along z, and one has a corresponding Dirac point. Okay, so here's now we're beginning to do some experiments for this system. What we're going to do in all the experiments for this spin orbit coupling project is we create an equal mixture of MF equals minus 1 and 0 in advance, no Raman coupling. We then turn on Raman coupling to some final value and see what happens. So what I'm plotting are the expected energy momentum curves at 0 to tuning as a function of Raman strength, and what we see are the two minimum coalesce into a single minima. So we performed the experiment, that is, we loaded this initial mixture of spins into the Raman dress states, and we measured the location of these minima, and what we see is just exactly as expected, a coalesce into a single minimum. What this demonstrates is that we really do understand our single particle Hamiltonian. Okay. When we started this project, we actually thought this is all there was going to be. We thought that we would demonstrate you could do a spin orbit coupling and we would move on. But in fact, something really interesting happened, and this happened at an extremely weak value of the Raman coupling. To understand that, you need to realize we made a mixture of two different spins, MF equals minus 1 and 0. And these spins interact in a way which isn't just a density-density interaction. So typically with rubidium, you say that the dominant term in the interaction just depends upon the density, independent of what the spin is. And that's generically pretty true. The C0 term is much bigger than C2. But C2 is not 0, it's small and negative. Okay, so there's a term which says that the density interaction between minus 1 in itself is different than 0 in itself. And crucially, the interaction between minus 1 and 0 has a small negative sign in front of it. What this means is that for the particular pair of states we're working with, minus 1 and 0, if you put them together, they should mix spatially. It gains a little bit of energy by mixing. If C2, like it is for sodium, was positive, these pair of states would tend to phase separate. So rubidium tends to phase mix. But there's one term that I've added here. If one then says, in fact, we have dress spins, and you go into the basis of these dress spins, then in this new basis, a new term appears in this Hamiltonian, which we call GSO. In other words, a new coupling term, which is resulting from this effect of Raman-induced spin orbit coupling. This GSO here is proportional to the coupling strength squared and C0. C0 is positive. The coupling strength squared is positive. Thus, GSO is positive, and we have a term which can change in sign. Okay, so this we can now favor phase separation instead of phase mixing. How's my time? Okay, so I'm going to make the long story short. We have the tuning parameter, and we can calculate the mean field phase diagram of the system. And what we discover is that if the detuning is large, the atoms will always both condense into the minimum of the energy-momentum relation. But when the detuning is very small, there's a window in which we can have an equal mixture of atoms, but vary the detuning. And what we observe, in fact, is exactly what we hope to see, that you go from a phase mixed state, you change the sign of this term, this effective G term, and the system undergoes a transition to a phase separated state. And here's the, given the shortness of time, I will skip that. Here's the outcome of that measurement. What I'm plotting is a function of coupling strength for an equal mixture of these dress spins and measure of the phase separation, which goes from essentially zero. And at a critical value of the coupling of just about 0.2, we begin to see the appearance of phase separation in the system. And absent any free parameters, knowing what we know about rubidium and our coupling strength, we computed this should happen at 0.19. So we see a genuine phase transition from a phase mixed to a phase separated state, from miscible to immiscible. And here are some data. This is time of flight data where we did the Stern-Gerlach, and then we recombined the images to make these plots. You see phase mixed here and the appearance of phase separation, where this region of white shows essentially equal mixing. Its width is a measure of the spin healing length. So we're able, by changing the Raman strength in the spin orbit coupled system, to drive what is a quantum phase transition from a phase mixed to a phase separated state. That's really neat. So I'd like to conclude my talk with a little bit of comment about the future. So I think just a couple weeks ago, we realized that this simple form of spin orbit coupling we did is enough to make a Dada-Das style transistor. I've illustrated that here. So this form of Hamiltonian we had before, as a function of position, as a function of laser intensity, can be rewritten at low energy in terms of a effective scalar potential and a modification of the spin-orbit coupling term. And it turns out this is enough that if you have a beam of a spin mixture to separate them, the separation between these is proportional not to the internal initial velocity, but only the length of this interaction region and the coupling strength. And this is the idea behind these sort of spin-orbit coupled transistors. I think that's really neat. But I think even neater is the kind of things you might be able to do with fermions into these systems. So I told you there's a problem with fermions, and that is they have a large spontaneous emission. But maybe you can overcome that. One way to overcome it is to notice in the spin-orbit coupled limit, you don't need much intensity to do something. So even at, say, 0.1 or 0.2 recoils, you can open up a pretty large gap there. Now, why is that interesting? Well, if the Fermi energy happens to be in that gap, that means you have just one Fermi surface. However, particles on one side of the Fermi surface have opposite spin than particles on the other side of the Fermi surface. So what you get is a peanut-shaped Fermi surface where you have a single component gas that interacts with itself. It's even better at the limit of strong coupling when you return to the limit of a round Fermi surface that still has different states on the different sides of the Fermi surface, meaning if you trace this higher curve out, you have a single component Fermi gas that is interacting with essentially P-wave interactions. And this is the first paper I was able to find from Shankar Desarma's group on this. So this is neat. This is a new way of creating P-wave interactions, not by using Feshbach resonances, but instead by exploiting the different spin states on the surface of what looks like a single component Fermi gas. Now, I'd like to conclude by saying, well, how can you do these things with fermions if I just told you spontaneous emission is large? Well, one way to do it is to realize that the vector light shift, this Raman coupling we're using, can be rewritten as something that looks like a spatially varying effective magnetic field. That is to say, a sinusoidal magnetic field that is propagating in time, and this propagating magnetic field drives transitions just like a spatially dependent RF field would. Well, that's great. Let's make a spatially dependent RF field. The catch, of course, is unless you're working in the Large Hadron Collider, some gigantic vacuum system, the 100-meter wavelength of this is kind of prohibitive. So the idea is to say, well, wait a second. We can use an atom chip, because really, at these length scales, the local magnetic fields are determined not by the wavelength of the radiation, but by the structure of the source current distribution. Okay. So this is a really neat idea by which a propagating magnetic field pattern can drive what looks like Raman transitions and free yourself, if you will, from the yoke of spontaneous emission and burden yourself with the technical curses associated with atom chips. So it's going from an in-principle problem to a technical problem, and we hope we are good enough to solve the technical issues. So if you're interested, here's a pretty nice reference showing both this type of idea and then some neat physics that can result from it. So this is the cast of characters who have been involved in some of this data. So this is Yu Zhu, who's now departing. This is Karina, who's taking over. And this is Trey, Bill, and myself, and a really good French stage student we had this summer. Thanks.
Thank you very much for a beautiful and very clear talk. Questions?
So Ian, you started by motivating with fractional quantum Hall effects. So can you give some idea what it would take to go all the way to, let's say, 1/3 or 5/2? 5/2 is even better because it's lower magnetic field. And what are the possible deal breakers along the way? Maybe that's 5 years down the line, but I would like to know.
Okay, so the question is, how do you do real quantum Hall physics with what we've done? So first, let's say you're working with bosons, which is what we're working with. And the state you're interested in is a bosonic analog of a Moore-Reed state, which happens at filling factor 1, which is really great. So that's a slightly larger field than the obvious Laughlin state at filling factor 1/2. So let's say the target is to go to filling factor 1. A great thing about bosons is we know by exact diagonalization studies that you really do have a Moore-Reed state at filling factor 1 for contact interacting bosons. So you have that in the bag. And then, which is different than electronic systems, because you hope you have a Moore-Reed state at filling factor 5/2. Okay, so you have something. The problem then is you need to actually reach that filling factor. And that ultimately is a question of energetics. So something I showed you but didn't delve into the consequences of is that this vector potential is bounded. It goes between plus and minus 2k recoil. And that ultimately gives you a limit in the number of flux quanta you can have, not per unit area, but by unit length, actually. So it turns out that for a system, say, of several hundred atoms, you can reach filling factor 1 with an aspect ratio of maybe 3 or 4 to 1. Now, for experimentalists, this means you're saying, I'm committing to make two-dimensional bosons with a couple hundred bosons at the temperature of a couple tens of nanokelvin. And that's just frankly a hard experiment. It's not impossible. I think we can do it, but it's not easy. Okay. So that's the answer to your question. The energy scales are what make it hard.
You may have already answered this question in what you just said, but a good figure of merit for these artificial created magnetic fields is magnetic length. So in these Raman schemes where you use relative orbital angular momentum of light beams, it turns out that the magnetic length is on the order of the square root of the optical wavelengths times some length scales given, say, by the core size of the vertex beam or something like this. So in principle, you can go down to all the way to magnetic lengths on the order of the wavelengths. Now, how is it in your scheme? I would guess that it should be on the order of geometric mean of wavelengths and then some magnetic field gradient. Can you tell me how small it can actually be?
Okay, so the question is, what's the magnetic length, which is more or less a separation between vortices if you had a DEC. So there's a fundamental limit, which adiabaticity limits you to, meaning you can't actually get below about the wavelength over 2 or something. Okay, so that when the gradient gets too big, you end up coupling these things together. So that's a hard limit. In practice, then, you say, provided I don't want the entire size of my system to be confined within a couple wavelengths, how big do I want it to be? So for practical gradients and so forth, we find magnetic lengths of about 1 micron to be pretty pleasing. Okay, and for that situation, you can end up with, if you had a BEC with lots of atoms, you'd have a system with maybe 8 or 10 vortices across, maybe 10, and then a similar, you know, per micron going on. And that's actually what I was quoting when I gave Shankar's answer.
Is there some way in your scheme to generate a truly non-abelian vector potential?
Right, so to make a
something like sigma xpx plus sigma ypy or Dresselhauser.
Yeah, okay, so I sort of emphasize this. The vector potential we made is abelian, and it was really abelian because it lived only in part of the x part of the kinetic energy. So if you have only 2 laser beams, you're stuck with that because you're only coupling along one direction. So you would never do anything to the other direction. So that is why we had that. So by adding another laser, which couples intelligently states together, so if I have beams along this direction and come up with one more, there's a number of papers which talk about tripod schemes, and we've come up with some other ones that would generate a genuine non-abelian vector field. It looks like the Rochebaud limit always occurs in some limit of infinite coupling, but it's some general sum of Rochebaud and Dresselhauser curve practical couplings.
Is there a way of creating a tripod scheme in your scheme?
There are equivalents of tripod scheme. So the ENS group has had some actual proposals for realizing tricepod, and we have some others.
So what's the limit of tunability of the gradient? I mean, if you want to change, modulate it locally, what's the size where you...
Okay. So my interpretation of the question is, we made a linear gradient, how about more interesting gradients?
That's right.
Okay, so with what we did in the lab with large external coils, all you can have are linear things. But remember that the vector light shift looks just like a magnetic field. And for the purposes of this, it still looks just like a magnetic field, meaning that if you're working, say, at 790 nanometers where there's no scalar light shift, you can, in fact, make any pattern you can make with light, and that would texture the magnetic field in interesting ways. So, for example, if I'm making a standing wave, you can make a staggered artificial magnetic field. So I think that's a fair answer.
Okay. I think we should move on. Thank you again.
Thanks.
For the nice talk and the discussion. Our next speaker is Maciej Levenstein from Barcelona, and he will be talking about non-abelian gauge fields with ultracold.